Case versus Scott, Mr. Christensen.
Apparently they didn't like the first argument. They're not staying for the second show.
Well, you can always come back tomorrow if you're here.
That's true. I'll be here tomorrow as well. Would the court like me to wait until the courtroom is clear?
No.
Okay. May it please the court, counsel. Again, I'm Joanna Christensen. I represent the appellant in this case, Walter Kevin Scott. I'd like to start with a different number in this case, and that's $608,000. $608,000 represents the amount of consequential damages imposed as restitution in this case, which nearly doubled the restitution obligation of Mr. Scott. The district court made no findings regarding this amount of restitution, part of which Mr. Scott agreed to, but like I said, $608,000 of which was a gross abuse of the Mandatory Victims Restitution Act. The Mandatory Restitution Victims Restitution Act contemplates restitution for the property that is the subject of the offense. Mr. Scott has agreed to pay that restitution. The remaining, which I have listed in great detail in my brief, is not the property that was the subject of the offense. Perhaps most egregiously are two different awards, one for attorney's fees to Cook Incorporated for time that their attorney spent investigating the fraud in this case. This court has clearly held many times that that is not an appropriate order of restitution. In fact, in the Arvantis case, it was an insurance company who was claiming attorney's fees for investigating the fraud that was done upon them, and this court held that that was not appropriately included in restitution.
Well, there's a difference between attorney's fees expended in order to bring a proceeding against the defendant and attorney's fees just to determine what the loss was.
I don't believe that the case law indicates there's that distinction, particularly from this court. The government has cited a case where attorney's fees were allowed, but in that case, the defendant filed a lawsuit against the victim, and as part of the offense was this lawsuit. The victim was entitled, was
but why required. Is that any different? I mean, what happened here as a result of his crimes is that this Cook Corporation, whatever it was, it didn't know how much he'd stolen. It didn't know. So wasn't part of its loss just trying to find out whether there was other missing money besides what they knew he had taken?
I don't believe so. The statute specifically speaks of property that was the subject of the offense. And while the rest of this restitution...
Well, it's the property of the Cook Corporation.
The property that Mr. Scott stole from Cook Corporation was the amount of money that was used for fraudulent invoices and for his own personal expenses. That was taken from Cook Incorporated. But what flowed from Mr.
Well,
Scott's offenses...
What if in the process of stealing the money he had broken a window? Would that be a proper subject of restitution?
I think if it was part of the offense... Yes, for
part of the offense. The way he steals the money, breaks the window, jumps in, steals it, and leaves. Now, is that window part of the loss for which restitution is available?
If the offense is still bank fraud.
I don't know why you're giving me ifs.
Well, Your Honor, because that's not the offense Mr. Scott was
convicted of. I don't care. This is a hypothetical question. You break in, you steal money from a safe, and in the process you break a window. Now, is that part of the loss for which restitution can be ordered, or just the money you took from the safe?
In that crime, it is. It is part of the loss.
Well, how about the money that the company spent to replace the window?
I believe that that is also part of it, but that's a different crime.
Well, why? What about the money it spends calling up to find out who can replace the window at least cost?
I would draw the line there. I think that becomes too attenuated. It becomes consequential.
Why?
Well, I agree with you.
What's the point? Some ground for drawing the line there? Some reason?
No, my ground and my reason is
technical.
Is this court's case law talking about attorney's fees? That line has been drawn.
You haven't had a case like my window case.
Not that I'm aware of, no, Your Honor. But you have had a case like Mr. Scott's case. I believe you've had several of them. One of them is, of course, the Arvantes case. The remainder of these restitution orders also do not fall into the Act, the Restitution Act. And, I'd like to go back to the attorney's fees. What the government is arguing in its brief is not supported by the record. We don't know what this attorney did, except for the allegations that are made in the government's brief, which I was not aware of, because they're not part of the record. And they can't be relied on to affirm any restitution award in this case. I also would like to remind the court that the actual amount of loss that was used for the sentencing calculation was only $744,000. I personally have never seen a case where restitution was in excess of the amount of loss unless the defendant had agreed to it in his plea agreement, which is permissible, but did not happen in this case.
Amount of loss to the company.
Amount of loss to both companies.
Well, yeah, but what, in addition to attorney's fees, there were other expenses as well, right?
There were, Your Honor. To Cook Incorporated, it was about $41,000 for their employees to review their records, $1,300 for them to rent a copier. I don't know exactly how that was necessary. It was just stated in the pre-sentence report. $72,000 for one audit of Cook, $50,000 for a second audit of Cook. Like I've said in my brief, even if one audit was appropriately ordered as restitution, the second audit could not have been.
You think one might have been appropriate?
I think that the reason they wanted the audit was appropriate. I don't think that either one...
Should have done it a lot sooner, I guess.
I would agree, Your Honor. I think that that is the case. And then, of course, the legal fees to Cook that we've discussed. As far as to PERF, there was a $330,000 charge for an audit that included things such as staff time, contractors, and additional computers, which I also think is a flagrant misuse of the statute. None of this has been supported, that they even needed this as part of their audit, but if they did, it's a mere consequence of Mr. Scott's offense.
Well, how do you deal with this section that the government cited, 3663A, AB4, which says, in any case, reimburse the victim for lost income and necessary child care, transportation, and other expenses incurred during participation in the investigation or prosecution of the offense or attendance at proceedings related to the offense?
I don't believe that there's support that is what this restitution order is for. It may be minimally...
Are they expenses incurred during participation in the investigation?
They may be. We have no way of knowing how much of this is a participation in the government's investigation and how much was something that Cook, Inc., or PERF needed to do for their own safety and their own financial awareness. I don't think that... It's certainly not in the record how much of that was appropriate under that section. It is possible that some of it was appropriate. We do not know that, partially because there were no findings.
You're distinguishing there's something about the government's investigation versus the company's own internal investigation?
I believe that that's a distinction that can be made. I don't know if that's been made by restitution cases in the past. It seems to me the government's trying to blur those lines and make them the same type of conduct. I believe it's very different. The government's investigation is separate from the company's investigation, which may have been necessary before.
The statute, look at now 1363A, the basic statute, says, court is supposed to consider the amount of the loss sustained by each victim as a result of the offense. That's very broad, and if they incurred this auditing expense as a result of the offense, they wouldn't have done it otherwise. Why isn't that covered?
This court's case law has interpreted as going
What's
a little
to interpret?
Further.
Amount of the loss resulting from the offense. Well, this was a loss, and it resulted from the offense.
I agree, Your Honor, but the court has drawn the line between
Why?
Damages and consequences.
Why would we do that when the
damages.
Language is so clear?
Well, that's perhaps not a question that I'm qualified
yes,
to answer.
Yes, you have to. Yeah, I mean, presumably we had a reason, or else we should re-examine and change our case law.
I believe
it's a senseless distinction.
I believe that a line has to be drawn somewhere.
Why? It's the amount of the loss resulting from. Why is it just
because
like any other tort?
In a case like this, loss could go on and on and on. It
so
could be
what?
The loss to.
If he really inflicted. Substantial ramifying losses, why shouldn't he be responsible?
Well, I see that my time is up. May I
sure.
answer your question? We don't know, like I was discussing, how much of this could have been stopped, needed to be done before Mr. Scott's offense, was part of his offense and was not part of the offense. Like, PERF conducted this $330,000 audit and discovered no fraud on the part of Mr. Scott, but fraud on the part of several other employees. Where do we draw the line between...
It's a simple question. Did they conduct the audit because of Scott's crime?
I think it was a result of, but it was a consequential damage to PERF. It was not a direct damage.
I understand you. Consequential damages are routinely recoverable for wrongful behavior.
I agree in civil cases, but this court has said that they are not available as restitution in criminal cases following the MVRA. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Ms. Christensen.
Thank you.
Mr. DeBroda?
May it please the court, Ms. Christensen. There were four issues really raised in the briefs. With the court's permission, I won't address the obstruction of justice issue.
Well, that's a serious one.
Okay, I will if the court wanted to.
That's a serious one.
With regard to the obstruction of justice issue, if you'd like me to address that first, I'll do that. The district court in this case took a look at Mr. Scott's conduct, measured against Section 3. C1.1. That the law behind that section helps.
But how did his behavior at this halfway house or whatever it is, how did this impede the government's investigation or prosecution of him?
It did it in this way. If I could expand your question slightly, 3C.
No, just answer my question. Did it impede the investigation or prosecution of Scott?
It wasted our time, and it forced us to investigate the bribery of VOA employees when, at that point in the case, we should have been done with what was a very expensive and long investigation. But I don't think that's the entire breadth
but
of 3C1.1.
Did you prosecute him for his... For his misconduct at the halfway house?
In part. There is a sentencing enhancement in the plea agreement and that's reflected in the sentence for that. So the answer
would
be yes.
Well, how did his conduct interfere with your ability to get that enhancement?
His conduct caused me to have to investigate the enhancement. It didn't interfere
well,
with my ability to get it.
That's true of all criminal conduct. You can't say criminal conduct is automatically obstruction of justice because it makes you have to investigate. So he has this, you know, string of commercial crimes that you're investigating, and then he misbehaves in this halfway house. Now, how did that interfere with your investigation or prosecution of him?
3C1.1 says the administration of justice.
No. Answer my question.
I think it caused me extra work, but I don't think that's
extra the work in order to nail him for the halfway house abuses, or extra work to investigate and prosecute him for the crimes for which he was originally charged?
I think I understand your question. The answer is both. It clearly required me to investigate the underlying bribery, and it also meant that I had to spend more time on his case because it necessitated the negotiation of a second supplemental or rather superseding plea agreement, and it changed the whole character of that prosecution. So I think it had both effects.
Changed character of what prosecution?
Of the underlying fraud money laundering prosecution.
And how has that changed?
Well, for example, Mr. Scott was cooperating with the government. If you read his first plea agreement, that was the result of the process. And at that time, the central question in the case was, because he had gotten a job as the chief benefits officer for the Public Employees Retirement Fund of Indiana, the question was, did he steal money from that employer like he had for great periods of time at Perf, or at, rather at Cook? That was the question. He denied that that was the case. His credibility was an important part of that analysis. Once we heard, while at the same time he was cooperating, he was bribing VOA employees and making false statements to get passes for medical treatment that he didn't have on 10 occasions, it became much more difficult for us to take him at his word on the other things that he was saying. So I think it did have an effect in terms of what our thinking was and the actions we took. That fits into the restitution argument, because what was going on here was you had a person who was the chief benefits officer who was a convicted identity thief and an embezzler from his prior employers, someone who we knew misused the identity of a victim that was a victim of his prior federal prosecution. He kept that guy's information for years, and we found in Mr. Scott's home the personal identifying information of 750 people. We needed to know from among all the PERF information he had access to, which was the personal identifying information of about 1.2 million people, whether or not he stole any of those funds. We also knew that he was pretty good at this because he got away with it completely at Cook. If it hadn't been for his second series of crimes, they never would have discovered that. So when you add all that together, his credibility mattered, and his conduct at the VOA, the bribery and so on, and the false statements that he made there did cause us more work and caused us problems. Now, I think, though, 3C1.1 goes beyond that. And I think that's what the district court said. Because 3C1.1 says the administration of justice during an investigation, prosecution, or sentencing. It doesn't say, does it impede the prosecutor? It's talking about the whole, all three steps of the case. And I think the administration of justice brings the court's time into it. And at bottom, what happened here was a very, very serious violation of the court's release conditions.
But are you suggesting any misconduct in jail awaiting trial is an obstruction of justice?
No, not at all. And let me draw a distinction. One of his other violations was getting an improper use of a cell phone on three occasions. I would not argue that that is obstruction. However, what happens here is we have 12 discrete acts, 2 briberies, 10 false passes, where what we're doing is we are affronting the judicial system it's hard to imagine a more serious way than that. It's really analogous to an escape. And what he's
Are you saying an escape is an obstruction of justice? How about after the person is convicted and he escapes from prison? You saying that's an obstruction of justice?
If he's been sentenced already, I don't think we could cycle back to 3C1.1. What I mean is an escape.
Well, what's the difference? I don't understand you. What is the difference?
I think an escape before sentencing while someone's on release, if they fail to show up willfully.
Well, that would obstruct justice,
sure.
Of course. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I think there would be situations under which an escape.
But when you talk about affronting, it's so vague, affronting the judge, insisting, I mean, thumbing his nose at, I don't know why is that obstruction of justice?
In this particular case, the judge didn't think it was a close call, and she cited a couple of considerations, which I agree with, if that's helpful. She said that it was rationally related to his prosecution or his investigation, because it means, and it meant more than simply lying to the prosecutor, to me. In particular, it wasted the court's time. It cost 2 VOA employees their jobs. They got fired. And it cast the system in disrepute in what was a very public case.
I don't think that disrepute has to do with obstruction of justice at all. It's just not the same thing.
I think a court, in setting conditions of...
Obstruction of justice means it's, you know, more difficult to investigate or prosecute a case. Not that it's insulting judicial system.
If it were as narrow as you're suggesting, I would lose. But I think the administration of justice language means it's broader than simply interfering materially with an investigation.
Well, it could interfere with the judge, right.
That's what I think it's doing. The administration of justice means that. Because
she had another crime to punish? Or?
What it did is it required the magistrate judge and the district judge to engage in a whole series of steps that were unnecessary, additional hearings, investigations by the probation office, and so on, all of which was a direct and proximate and material result of his misconduct. Now, the seriousness of it really isn't any question here. I mean, obviously, bribing VOA employees for someone on lockdown status, which is what he was, and using those passes instead of legitimate medical treatment ordered by the court to go engage in sex with people, to do business deals with people in the VOA, that's all in the record. That's what he was really doing. That was, I think, a sufficient consideration for this district judge to make the finding that she did. Now, it is not squarely what the 3C1.1 language rules in, rules out one way or the other. But I think that's important to consider against the fact that the conduct, according to Application Note 3, varies widely. There is no precise definition of it, says Application Note 3. And it's a non-exhaustive list, essentially. We think at the end of the day, when you do the analysis, as we put in our brief, this is a serious example of obstruction. Now, our argument in the alternative was this is a departure. And we said it should be scaled to two levels because it's a departure like an obstruction. The judge never ruled on that because I won the argument as a guideline application issue. But in the event that the court disagrees, this should be remanded for the district court to consider that as a departure ground. Now, post-Booker, it's, we think, absolutely a 3553 ground that would be a variance reason. If this isn't an upward departure and this isn't an obstruction, it's certainly a variance. Mm-hmm. His sentence could get the same or worse depending on how she scaled it. On the restitution issue, let me just state that we recognize that the cases that this court has had up to now are very fact-specific. This is the case that has to test the proposition of how broadly restitution rights really exist. I'm reading that section and reading the cases and seeing ways of distinguishing it. So it was not my place to tell the Public Employees Retirement Fund of Indiana that it couldn't get restitution in the amount here. And it wasn't my place to say that to Cook either, particularly where that we think there's a waiver here that Scott took tactical advantage of.
Yes, but putting the waiver aside, is there any sort of is there some limit about consequential damages, and what are they? I'm very confused about that.
I think the limit is the statute, clearly, and there you could get things that are completely
fanciful. The statute seems unlimited when it says, you know, amount of loss as a result of the offense.
I think when you get to the... May I finish answering the question?
Sure. No, take your time, because you got diverted into that obstruction issue.
With regard to the breadth of the statute, we can see the court's prior cases, and they envision specific circumstances where it got too attenuated. And that would include, for example, parallel civil litigation and the cost of that. What we're talking about in this case, from what the court can see in the record, and it's really in three places. It's in the pre-sentence report, including the victim impact statements, which are typed in there, and also the factual basis that the defendant agreed was true beyond a reasonable doubt during the change of plea hearing, that there were these costs that were a direct result of the crime. There was no further parsing of it because at the time the defendant should have made a specific objection and, in fact, made other objections. He didn't make one. And that's what the court has then. It has this incomplete record because of what I call a waiver, but at a minimum, with the record the court has, there really isn't a way to parse this distinction, except the district court was persuaded that this was a result of his getting the job at PERF and all the damage that occurred there, and his working at Cook. Now, what those lawyers were doing, I was not afraid to prove. And in fact, we had witnesses sitting there ready to do it. That's what I thought the sentencing hearing was going to be about. It didn't turn out that way. But I don't think what I should do in the face of them not even objecting at all and having discussed this with me for weeks in plea negotiations, I don't think it's my job to put on evidence and do further once they agree to the number, which is what I think they did. Mm-hmm. So there we are. My interpretation is this statute's broad enough to get these categories, and it's distinguishable from the prior cases, so we need to now hear what the law is on this. Can I make one brief Booker point, Your Honor? There are two salient considerations we think bear on the third and fourth Booker prongs. This is a case with an upward departure in it and a sentence at 1 month short of the high end of the range. So, and I know the court's been dealing with this issue all week. We think those two factors, coupled with what is otherwise, we believe, a correct guideline application, mean that it's very highly unlikely that the district court, even under an advisory system, would give a different sentence. That's our essential position there. Now, in terms of looking at that issue, we believe Rodriguez has it right. And with regard to the court's...
Rodriguez goes much further than that.
It does, and it relies on the...
It doesn't rely on, you know, whether there's been an upward departure or anything. It just says, you know, it's never plain error because the defendant can never prove that there would have been a lower sentence unless the judge said, you know, I would have given you a lower sentence if my hands weren't tied by the guidelines.
I agree. That's how you could read Rodriguez correctly, I think. I think our case is stronger than Rodriguez's facts because of the upward departure and the court's comments in the case in front of the court, plus the high-end sentence. So the concerns addressed earlier in the week, what about a sentence at the low end? What about a sentence in the middle? I doubt seriously very many district judges ever gave a high-end sentence while thinking the overall range was unreasonable or so on. So that's our position.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. DeBroda. Ms. Christensen? There's time. Well, you can have a couple of minutes if you'd like.
Thank you, Your Honors. I will go ahead and address the obstruction issue since I did not get to that during my opening argument, and I apologize for that. As is clearly laid out in the brief, Mr. Scott's conduct did not amount to obstruction of justice. It did not impede the investigation, prosecution, or sentencing in this case. And the guideline is specifically tailored to those situations. It provides parameters on one side what is obstructive conduct and the other side perhaps what is not. The government and I actually agree that Mr. Scott's conduct is most like an example that is not obstruction, which is the defendant lying about drug
use.
Well,
but what he said was that forced the judge to put in more time on the case, as well as forced the prosecutor renegotiate the plea agreement.
Correct. And
Scott had shown himself even more unreliable and dishonest than appeared.
And to that point, I would say that the government is making a good argument that it affected their ability to use Mr. Scott's cooperation, which is not a consideration under the obstruction of justice guideline. How the government is able to proceed with cooperation the defendant has given.
The government is saying it made more work for it and for the district judge.
I don't believe that it made more work in that it impeded anything. No deadlines got set back.
No, it doesn't have to impede. If it piles on more work, you know, like we have these wild goose chase cases. So the defendant he doesn't interfere with the investigation. But what he says is, oh, you know, someone else did it, and then the government goes and investigates that, goes on that wild goose chase, so they lose time and waste money and so on.
Correct.
And that's obstruction of justice.
Correct, and that's during...
So what isn't it what he did by these antics of his? He's awaiting trial, and he's engaging all these antics at this halfway house, and as a result, the prosecutor and the judge have additional work put on them.
I would say that in that case, in your example, that is impeding the investigation, that they are investigating the offense the defendant has been arrested for, and he sends them off on this way and he sends them off on that way. Mr. Scott had already entered into a plea agreement, and in fact, he made it easy for them by entering into a second plea agreement where he admitted the conduct and admitted that he no longer should receive acceptance of responsibility.
Right, but what it means is that the matter had to be reopened to take away his acceptance of responsibility because he had acted up while awaiting trial. So he imposed additional work, not a great deal, obviously, but he put some additional work on the prosecutor and on the judge.
And I believe that is analogous to the defendant's use of illegal drugs while on pretrial release. That also puts additional work on the court and the probation officer who probably have to revoke his pretrial release. It is another illegal act, as the government alleges the bribery in this case was. I believe that they are mirrors of one another. And I see that I am out of time, and I'll rest on the remaining arguments in my brief unless the court has further questions.
Okay, thanks very much, Ms.
Thank you.
Christensen and Mr. DeBroda.